Hello, and welcome to Talking General Practice, the podcast from GP Online. I'm Emma Bauer, the editor of GP Online. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to Dr. Caroline Watson, who's the chair of the Royal College of GP's Secure Environment Group and has over a decade of experience working as a GP in prisons in England. In this conversation, Caroline explains how she got involved in working in secure environments, what working in these environments entails, and the challenges faced by GPs working in them. She also discusses the complexities of prescribing in prisons, the common health issues seen in prisoners, and the multidisciplinary teams that GPs work alongside. Caroline also shares her insights into the rewarding aspects of working in secure environments and the role of the RCGP Secure Environments Group in championing improving healthcare for people in contact with the criminal justice system. And she offers some practical advice for GPs interested in this career path. Before we move on, just to let you know that MIMS Learning Live is returning to London on Friday the 13th of June, and this year it's heading to a brand new venue, the ILEC Conference Centre in Earls Court. Brought to you by our colleagues on MIMS Learning, this is an event you won't want to miss. It's your chance to boost your clinical know-how, connect with peers from across the UK, and gain fresh insights that can help make a real difference in your patients' lives. Spots will go fast, so head to mimslearninglive.com/London and get your ticket today. I'm delighted to welcome onto the podcast now Dr. Caroline Watson. Caroline is chair of the RCGP Secure Environments Group and has over a decade of experience working as a GP in prisons in England. She is currently clinical director of Northamptonshire Healthcare NHS Trust Secure Services and works as a GP at HMP Bedford. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Caroline.
Great pleasure.
So first of all, I was interested in finding out, how did you get involved in working as a GP in secure environments? What led you to this line of work?
Well, I started off in mainstream general practice and then moved into working with people experiencing homelessness and really enjoyed this. We then moved area and there was no specialist homeless practice in that area. And I fell into prison that way because of the many parallels of health inequalities, social exclusion, drug and alcohol use, mental health, complex physical need. There's a huge parallel there between people experiencing homelessness, people in contact with criminal justice system, and indeed many other of the inclusion health groups.
So you're the chair of the RCGP Secure Environments Group. When we talk about secure environments, what exactly are we referring to? Prisons is only just part of that, isn't it?
There's prisons, Young Offenders Institute, secure training centres. There's a secure school that was opened recently. We also look after people in immigration removal centres and in secure hospitals.
I sort of gave a bit of a flavour of your job titles at the start. So where exactly is it you work now and what does that role involve?
Well, I've got about three roles. As clinical director, that is overseeing the clinical quality at six prisons and the immigration removal centre over in the east of England. I do clinical work in Bedford Prison, which is a remand and local prison, Category B prison. And I also work part-time in a GP surgery in the community, which is for inclusion health. It's the Access Surgery over in Cambridge.
Most GPs won't necessarily have spent any time in any of these kind of environments, and most people generally don't have much contact with the criminal justice system. It sounds like it must be quite a challenging environment in which to work. What are some of the key challenges you face sort of day-to-day in providing GP care to patients in a secure environment compared within the community? How is it different from being a GP in a standard practice?
So in a standard practice, if you want to refer a patient to hospital or if you want to ask them to have treatment that's outside of the surgery, that is something that the patient is free to do. Every movement of people in prisons depends on the prison staff. So to get patients to come to see you for an appointment depends on the prison staff availability to unlock and escort people over to the clinic. If somebody needs to go out to hospital, then escorting arrangements need to be made to ensure that any movement is done outside of a prison is secure and that the risk of escape is mitigated. So all the care is very much based around the regime of the prison. So you've actually got two systems working, the prison with a security agenda and health with a different agenda, and sometimes those are competing. It can be difficult to provide timely care. One of the emerging issues that has arisen because of capacity that people may well be aware of is that people are being moved through prisons very rapidly. So if in the community I was looking after a patient, I would imagine that I would be able to bring them back, that I would be able to arrange investigations if they needed them and refer them to hospital. They'd wait for their hospital appointment, they would be seen and they'd have the treatment that they needed. In the prison, I may see somebody, arrange investigations, refer them, and before they've had the opportunity to go to a hospital or have their investigations done, they may have been moved on to another prison. So the work then has to start all over again.
Who's actually responsible for healthcare in prisons? Is it the NHS or is it the prison service?
It's the NHS.
Right, okay. How does that work then? So it's basically, it's the local ICB is responsible for organising that. Is that how it works?
Well, no, that's an interesting thing. That there is specialised commissioning by NHS England Health and Justice. So it is actually distinct and separate. And that will be interesting to see how we can build on integration as integrated neighbourhoods health begins to take more shape in the coming months.
Who else do you work alongside in a secure environment like prisons? Who are your day-to-day colleagues and part of the healthcare team? What other clinical staff would be working in a secure environment?
It's actually a real privilege because we work as part of a primary care team with nurses, healthcare support workers. We work alongside the drug and alcohol teams, both psychosocial and clinical. We work alongside mental health colleagues. So that's nurses, psychologists, psychiatrists. We have allied health professionals such as physiotherapists, podiatrists who may come in. And there's dentistry and opticians, as well as the actually very valuable colleagues among the prison who we are, as a health team, part of the prison and need to work very closely together, particularly to support patients who have maybe injured themselves or are feeling suicidal or have particularly complex drug and alcohol, physical health and mental health needs. So there's a lot. It's like a big, almost like an integrated neighbourhood under one roof.
So you've touched on some of the health issues that you have to deal with. Drugs and alcohol misuse sounds like a big one. Are there any common health issues that you do see in prisoners? Is the range of conditions that you see and treat, you know, is it very different from what you would see in a normal GP practice?
There is definitely a lot of drug and alcohol related and mental health problems. But there's a lot of complexity. So very similar to if you imagine an inclusion health population where people may have neglected their health needs or they have disengaged from service because of loss of trust or difficult experiences with either health or with other authority figures. We find often people present late with more complex issues. So it's very much like a concentrated version of complexity that occurs in prisons.
Do you actually come across people who've perhaps not engaged with any healthcare for a really long time and that's the first opportunity they've really had for a long time to engage with a doctor?
Yes. Sometimes when people come in, it will be the first time that they can actually catch up with their screening, they can have vaccinations, they can actually get on top of their health. And certainly I've worked with patients who've had very poor, for example, diabetes control that is because of the level of monitoring that is possible under one roof, it's been better controlled. So there are ways, and certainly people, if they are leading a chaotic lifestyle because they're struggling to find housing, you know, that shelter, the food, or if they've been struggling because their focus of the day has been to find the next drug hit, it gives them a break from that, and we provide, obviously, opiate substitute treatment, as you would have in the community, as well as the psychological therapies that go with that, and we provide treatment for alcohol detoxification. So it often will give people a bit of a break from some of the chaos that their lives may hold out in the community.
Do you need any specific skills or training to work as a GP in a secure environment? Do you need to have special training in substance misuse, or is it just useful to have that?
It is possible to work in a secure environment without having experience of either patients who've been homeless or are in an inclusion health group. Substance use is particularly important in remand, which is the type of prisons where people first come in from the community. But often in long-term training prisons, you may actually be dealing with a very similar population as you may see in the community.
How does the prison environment itself impact on the health of prisoners? Does it cause any particular challenges for specific conditions or anything like that?
Well, there are still a number of prisons that were built in Victorian times. And for example, the doorways are small. It's very hard to get a wheelchair through. The actual cells are shared often because of the overcrowding. If you need any additional equipment, again, that is very difficult. People's mental health can be severely impacted, both by being in prison, for example, if you're on remand and not certain what's the outcome of your court case going to be, or because there may be limited hours that are out of somebody's cell. So they've actually got very little contact with the outside, you know, fresh air or green spaces. Equally, contact with families may be limited. There are now phones that people have access to. Before COVID, people would have to queue up on the landing in that half an hour out of their cell and wait to speak to somebody, and they may only be allowed out at, you know, the middle of the day when their partner or, you know, family are at work or school. So physical health can be impacted by sometimes delays to actually being seen in a hospital if people are being moved around the estate, or if somebody moves from prison back out into the community and their care continuity is changed.
What happens when it comes to prescribing? Are there any special rules and ways things need to work if you're issuing medicines to people?
The issue of prescribing, and then there's the issue of medicines administration. So if Right. you're in the community, you would be prescribed your medicines. Now, in certain practices, certainly the practice I work in the community, if they're living without a roof over their head, then it may be hard to give 28 days worth of medicines at one time. So you may prescribe for a week at a time. When somebody comes into prison, they have what's called an in-possession risk assessment. Certainly if somebody's feeling, because they've come into prison, like harming themselves or they're feeling like ending their lives, they wouldn't have their medicines given in possession. So that can impact on the timing. So for example, you imagine you're on pain medication, which is due to be given over a 24-hour period. Now, medicines administration will happen at 8:30 in the morning, for example, 11:30 and 4 o'clock. And then occasionally a small number of people will have an 8 o'clock in the evening. So actually, for the majority of people, they have to have that 24 hours worth of medicines in just over 7 hours. So you have to remember that impact when prescribing. But there's also the issue of prescribing high-risk and dependence-forming medicines. And in fact, really, the prison prescribing woke up to dependence-forming medicines and the issues around this about 10 years before, really, the community has. We have had practices of multi-professional either risk assessment meetings or actually joined up consultations to try and manage people's complex prescribing and their complex needs and see where there isn't a clinical indication how we can deprescribe but support. So for example, somebody may come in with chronic pain, they've been on a high dose of pregabalin, but actually they no longer have a clinical indication for this, and it may be appropriate that it's being deprescribed and tapered, but actually there's an element of emotional pain there, and this is what they have relied on. They've had drug and alcohol issues, they may have adverse childhood experiences. So if you are deprescribing, you're also taking away kind of emotional blanket, and that needs to be supported either through the psychosocial team of the substance misuse team or through the mental health. So there's complexity and there's multi-professional working that goes around prescribing. I think the other thing to be aware of is that there is a lot of bullying and trading and debt that happens as a result of medicines that people prescribe. So mirtazapine, which is prescribed quite a lot in the community, sleep is very much at a premium in prison. prison. There's got a lot of time on their hands and sleep can be often very difficult. So you can actually sell your mirtazapine for quite some value. And there's a markup of trade from what you would buy in the community of prescribed medicine, illegal trading. It's about 10 times markup in a prison. If you have somebody prescribed tramadol, that would be extremely valuable. If somebody comes in prescribed buprenorphine, that will be potentially a very valuable medicine. And so somebody may be bullied in a medicine queue to try and have that medicine from them. Equally, if somebody buys some and then gets into debt, their families on the outside, they can be threatened or payment has to go through family members. We certainly see when there are more drugs in the prison, and that includes the prescribed drugs as well, that the safety impact has a whole impact on the whole prison. So that there's quite a lot of putting the context of prescribing within prisons, while at the same time remembering that people will have real need as well, particularly when it comes to complex pain.
How do you deal with that? Is it easy to work out whether they're actually taking their medicines or whether they're passing them on to someone else?
There are ways of mitigating the risk. So for the highest risk medicines or that those that are highest risk of trading, and in those prisons where you have high risk of trading, so for example, remand, and you've got an unstable population, and you've got quite a lot of risk of self-harm and suicide and violence, those sort of medicines can be taken under supervision. So that's one way of removing. However, you have an officer who will be checking the mouths of the person to check that they aren't trying to conceal the medicine. You will have somebody who will be checking to see if there's any activity in the medicine's queue. And if that does happen, then the person will have a review with the prescriber to discuss actually, what was the context to this? Were they being bullied for their medicine or what was happening? Do they not need it? And if they don't need it, then it is deprescribed because we're looking at the safety of the individual who's prescribed the medicine, the safety of the people who aren't prescribed it, who might either be getting it, and the safety and the stability of the whole prison. So it's quite a complex art to it. But I think that equally, if people have medicines in possession, it does mean sometimes they can take it at a better time. So the prison I work in, people have to have their mirtazapine at 4:30 in the afternoon because that is when the medicines round is. Now, you may fall asleep and then you're wide awake from 10 in the evening. So it can have a real impact on the benefit of medicines. So you're weighing up what would otherwise be a safe and reasonable medicine and is actually something that could cause harm in a prison.
Do you have like a certain level of care that you can provide within the prison? And, you know, are there sort of hospital bays and bits like that in the prison? Or does everybody just have to be sent out into the NHS if they need a certain level of care?
Well, there is variation across the regions. There's variation across the prison type. So we've talked about remand prison, category B local, where people come straight in from the community and from the local community. There are also category A prisons, which are the highest security, and there are C, which are where people remain on site, and D is the open category. So if you're in D category prison, actually, you're more able to get to external appointments without the escort. If you're in A, B or C, then you will need an escort with the prison staff. However, in remand prisons, there will be 24-hour nursing care provided. So there will be a level of cover of care. When we talk about inpatient units or healthcare units, they're actually cells. They're a wing and they are cells that are locked. They will be locked from the time that the afternoon regime finishes, which might be 5 in the afternoon. They won't be unlocked again until the next morning. So it's not like having the same access as you would to a patient in hospital. If you do overnight need to see a patient, then that patient can be unlocked, but you have to ask permission of the duty custodial manager to have someone come and unlock that cell. It's very different and it's not the same level of care as you might imagine an inpatient or a 24-hour care in a hospital at all.
All public services are under massive financial pressure at the moment. Are there any other impacts that those kind of financial constraints have on the way care can be provided in secure environments?
The staffing shortage and retaining staff is a real challenge. We not only have the impact of if you've got staffing, healthcare staffing, but if you have prison staffing shortage, that means that the care can't be facilitated as easily. So often you may need to rearrange a hospital appointment because there aren't enough officers to be able to facilitate that additional escort. The full and the overcrowding impact, the real impact is that capacity and churn. So you are dealing with high numbers of people who are coming in every day, new patients with undifferentiated health need that you need to assess, who may have quite a lot of unmet needs that they have been sitting on in the community unaddressed. A lot of the focus, particularly in the remand prisons where the churn is so high, is on managing acute and immediate need, managing actually the reception processes that need to be provided, and administering medicines. And acute managing, so incidents on the wing. So if there are several people who've become intoxicated because there's drug infiltration in the prison, for example, spice, that can impact. So you've got a backdrop of staffing shortage. You've also then got additional acute needs that are caused by the safety and impact of, for example, drugs and violence in the prison.
We're talking about lots of the challenges, and it sounds like it's a really tough environment to work with, and obviously very challenging patient group. But you've been doing this for a long time, so you must find it a rewarding place and environment to work. Why do you like this work? What do you get out of it?
It is a real privilege. It's a privilege to have any patient share their immediate needs with you, or those that are pressing or those that are on their mind. So to be able to manage complexity, to be able to actually see significant difference in somebody's health, to offer somebody a trauma-informed service where they may otherwise not have engaged with healthcare, is a really valuable role.
So coming on to the RCGP Secure Environments Group. So you're the chair of that group. What does that role involve?
The Royal College of GPs Secure Environments Group is there to champion and identify the issues that are pressing within prison care and to improve and look to improve the health of people who are in contact with the justice system. So that happens both through quarterly meetings that we have, but we also have an annual Health and Justice Summit where there is research shared, where there's best practice shared, and where we hear from policymakers, we hear from people with lived experience, a vast range of people. So there's a lot of education that goes on. We also have teamed up with the Royal College of Nursing and the Royal College of Psychiatrists to form a collaboration called the Health and Justice UK. Through that, we offer communities of practice which support clinicians and people working in secure environments in the different regions. So if you are, for example, a midwife and working in a women's prison over in the east of England, it may be that you aren't working with many other midwives who are working with secure environments, but there is an opportunity to both meet as part of a community of practice for the east of England, or actually with other midwives who are providing that clinical role in other prisons. There's equally the same for nursing, for GPs. So we have multi-professional, interprofessional, inter-provider learning that we offer through these communities of practice, which goes on, depending on the actual group, it will go on two or three times a quarter. So we're able to support, we are able to provide support for national stakeholder groups. So we will inform, we were asked to inform on a clinical basis, the clinical reference group for NHS England. And we will work with HMPPS, His Majesty's Prison and Probation Service.
Are there any specific training or resources available for GPs? So you talked there about, is it mostly just through those kind of groups where people can come together, or do you have any training resources and information for GPs working in prisons?
I originally held a role as clinical champion before I became chair. And in that role, we developed a suite of resources. So there are online resources for people to pick up on all the different areas of health, for example, prescribing or what to do when you're starting out in a prison. So there are resources that are available online. There are also, there's an e-learning package. So we have provided resources and continue to provide statements to support good clinical care.
If there's any GPs listening to this or nurses who are potentially interested in pursuing a career or working in a prison as part of a portfolio career, what advice would you give them if they wanted to do that?
I would say get involved, inquire, see where your local prison is, or contact the Royal College of GPs Secure Environments Group. We'd be delighted to put you in touch. I think it's really good when we see students, medical students or nursing students or GPs who are doing their training actually come in and have a taste of what prison is like. They will often want to come back. So I would say if you would like to find out more, your local prison team will be delighted to hear from you and actually will provide you with support and opportunities that may just open your eyes to a career that you'd never thought of before. It is a fantastic opportunity. It is difficult, but with the right support, and we try to offer that support through the Royal College of GPs Secure Environments Group, it's a really good career. I would say it is a good one to actually even think of as part of an inclusion health profile. So if you're interested in people who have got severe multiple disadvantage, then this is another really good population.
You talked a little bit earlier about recruitment and retention. Is that a real challenge in prisons for medical staff?
When we think of medical staff, I'm thinking of psychiatrists and I'm thinking of general practitioners. There is a real shortage of forensic psychiatrists that's national. So if you are wanting somebody to come in and to work in a prison, that can be a hard ask. However, when people come and work, they often will stay. What I would say is that it's a real opportunity. People can provide two sessions a week in a prison or even one. They could work full time. It's a real opportunity to have it as part of a portfolio. And I think there's a real benefit to having people who also work in the community as well as working in the prison, because it provides that added support and the added perspective of what it's really like when somebody goes back out into the community. And that's one of the reasons why I actually took back up the role that I'd been working in before, in the same practice I worked in before I ever went into prisons, because of that sort of continuity piece.
From your perspective as being the chair of the RCGP Secure Environments Group, what are the biggest changes or improvements you'd like to see in prison healthcare in the UK? If you could get a word with someone at the top table in the government, what would you say they needed to do to improve things?
We need to look at how we can better integrate with the ICBs around us, with the ICS. So with the neighbourhood, I think that where the challenges lie, they're often related to continuity. And if you can build or have built in better links with, for example, your local hospital or your local GP practices, or I think there is a real opportunity. I mean, even the IT system is not the same as the community. We have System 1, but it's not the same version of System 1. It's a more rudimentary version. If we could integrate more closely with the neighbourhood around us, I think it would improve the connection when people leave prison. It might even prevent people coming back into prison. It would help to support a more integrated workforce planning. We could probably get better shared assets as well. If you've got staffing who are working actually cross-sector with a greater understanding, I think that will help the patient group too.
Do people usually end up, if they are convicted and they get a sentence, do they usually end up in a prison sort of near their local area? So are they likely, when, for example, when they come out of prison, are they likely to be quite near the place they've been in prison? So that kind of continuity across with their healthcare would be useful.
If somebody's serving a long sentence, they may move prisons both during the sentence or they may be located away from their families. For women, because there are only 12 prisons in the country, they're often located a long way from their families. So, but often if people are coming towards the end of a long sentence, they may be moved back to their local area so that planning can happen. So I think that if you had continuity of roles and clinical continuity that went across, that there is services that have been set up to support continuity. So there is a non-clinical service which is called Reconnect, which has been developed to support people with health needs when they leave prison. So they will help to re-register with a GP, or they may be with a drug and alcohol service. But if there was a connection and integration with the actual community around, I think it would have a better impact on, as I say, the understanding, but also all those pathways, the referral pathways. If we were not having to lift and shift the referrals, that would benefit the patients as well.
What advice would you give to practices if they have new patients coming onto their list who have spent a period of time in prison? Is there anything that you would recommend that they should be doing, the GPs at those practices?
I think it's not just the GPs. I think it's right from the waiting room, the reception staff, and that welcome. It's really thinking of a trauma-informed. So really being aware of the backstory that people will have. Very, very often people in prison will have multiple adverse childhood experiences that have led down that path that has ended up in the prison or in community justice services. So there often is a real reason why. It's the what has happened to that person. Try and have that empathy, the understanding, but also really check the notes to check was the prescribing that you might have had before the person went into prison. Actually, was some of that thought to be no longer necessary? Had it been tapered and stopped, don't just automatically restart the medicines because somebody has come to you and said they'd like all their medicines again, because that can be very frustrating for prison teams who may have worked for sort of 6-8 months with somebody to bring them down, and then they come back in on a license recall a couple of weeks later with all back on lots of high-risk medication again.
It's been so interesting talking to you about medical care and secure environments, Caroline. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week. Thanks again to Caroline, and thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week, so please do join me then. In the meantime, don't forget you can keep up to date with all the latest news affecting general practice and access lots of other resources on our website at gponline.com.